Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 131, The Adams Family. I'd like to start off this week by thanking everybody who was involved with the Intelligent Speech 2020 conference. Last weekend, I had a fantastic time listening to all the brilliant talks, as well as giving two of my own. I had a solo talk where I got to compare the Second Punic War to the Seven Years' War, as well as have a live Q&A with some listeners. Then I was on the Ancient History panel with Ryan from the History of Ancient Greece, Dominic from the History of Egypt, and Jenny and Jen from Ancient History Fangirl. I'm not sure what exactly is going to happen with the audio from those two sessions, but I'm sure it will be made available one way or another. It was also a resounding success, I think. So we'll be doing it again in the not-too-distant future, but that's enough shop talk. In our last episode, we looked at how the reaction to the Stamp Act and the Quartering Act heated up across America. After the Virginia Resolves were published in New England, with a few more clauses, a series of riots broke out. Stamp distributors were forced into resigning left, right, and centre, with the notable exception of Georgia. In a desperate attempt to gain some control over the situation, the colonial assemblies spent late 1765 issuing further resolves along the lines of Virginia's, namely denouncing taxation without representation. A Stamp Act Congress was held in New York to establish a unified response, but there was a problem with this approach. If they appealed to Parliament, they would explicitly acknowledge Parliament's authority over them, which was in direct opposition to their own argument. They petitioned the King, which wasn't an issue, but their petition to the Commons ended up rather confused. The line they took was that the Commons should voluntarily make a distinction which acknowledged their legislative authority over the American colonies, but that they did not have the authority to tax. If that sounds strange to you, well, it was. But more interesting than the colonists' failure to produce a cohesive position was their ability to form a unified response that both the American conservatives and American radicals could support. And trying to find any response at all was not an easy task. Over October and November, the colonists attempted to find a way to oppose the Stamp Act in a manner that would not compel the British to use force. There was very nearly a clash between the military and the activists in New York, but that was a unique set of circumstances. On the whole, it was decided that violence would not be useful, and instead, ostracism would be a better means. If a judge would not use unstamped paper, the judge would be ostracised for their opposition to liberty. The merchants took a similar approach. There had been suggestions in Boston going back to 1764 that American merchants refused to import any goods from Britain, and this was adopted officially in September 1765. New York followed in October and Philadelphia in November. This would hurt British merchants and British workers, who would then put pressure on Parliament. In the Boston Gazette, one writer wrote that he would, quote, "rather the Spitalfield weavers should pull down all the houses in Old England and knock the brains out of all the wicked great men there, than that Americans should lose their liberty," end quote. The supposed author of this was Humphrey Ploughjogger, a man of the country who, in his own words, was not book lant enough to write so politely as the great gentlefolks that write in the newspapers. And I'm really not making fun of the accent, that's how it's spelt. Humphrey Ploughjogger was, of course, a pseudonym, and the character's creator was John Adams. Adams was born in October 1735, making him 30 during the Stamp Act crisis, at the family farm in Braintree, Massachusetts. His mother was from a leading local medical family, while his father had been a farmer. He entered Harvard College and graduated in the class of 1754. He set up a legal practice and achieved great success, but he had an interest in politics and writing, and in the early 1760s started writing for the Gazette with his Humphrey Plough jogger character. But it was the Stamp Act crisis that really let Adams begin to establish himself as a key figure, bombarding the Gazette, but all from the sidelines. He watched, but he wasn't yet ready to take action, like his cousin, Sam Adams. Adams will go on, of course, to have a lengthy revolutionary and political career, and will be a part of our narrative for some time. But he's particularly interesting for his extensive correspondence and writings, which make him such a valuable source. His own insight in December 1765 was, quote, "The year 1765 has been the most remarkable year of my life. That enormous engine, fabricated by the British Parliament for battering down the rights and liberties of America, I mean the Stamp Act, has raised and spread through the whole continent a spirit that will be recorded to our honour with all future generations. In every colony, the stamp distributors and inspectors have been compelled, by the unconquerable rage of the people, to renounce their offices. Such and so universal has been the resentment of the people that every man who has dared to speak in favour of the stamps, how great soever his abilities and virtues, had been esteemed before, or whatever his fortune, connections and influence had been, has been seen to sink into universal contempt and ignominy. The people, even to the lowest ranks, have become more attentive to their liberties, more inquisitive about them, and more determined to defend them, than they ever were before known or had occasion. Innumerable have been the monuments of wit, humour, sense, learning spirit, patriotism and heroism erected in the several colonies and provinces in the course of this year. Our great presses have groaned, our pulpits have thundered, our legislatures have resolved, our towns have voted. The crown offices have everywhere trembled, and all their little tools and creatures have been afraid to speak and ashamed to be seen." End quote. Adams wrote many times over the following weeks about the emerging unity from different groups around the colonies, but his writings reveal one group he completely missed. One that didn't even occur to him. Women. We've talked about the merchants and the journalists and the lawyers who were opposed to the Stamp Act, but women were also involved in the crowds. At this moment, in late 1765, they really started to take a more active role, indeed a leading role, in the ostracising tactics. Domestic servants for royal officials were needed to make the system work. The merchants may have proposed to ban imports of British goods, but women were suddenly required to produce textiles to make it work. At this juncture, I'd like to introduce another key figure into the narrative, often described as a key advisor to Adams, or a founding father in her own right, Abigail Adams. Abigail Smith was born in November 1744 in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Her mother, Elizabeth, was from the Quincy family, a political family of high standing in Massachusetts society. Her cousin, Dorothy Quincy, would marry one of the wealthiest men in the colonies, John Hancock, who we'll get round to introducing soon enough. Her father, William, was a congressional minister. Abigail didn't receive a formal education, but her mother taught her to read and write, and she had access to the large libraries of her father, grandfather, and uncle. She read English and French literature with friends, and it's safe to say she had one of the most erudite minds to ever reside in the White House. She met John Adams in 1759 when she was 15 and he 25. his friend being betrothed to her older sister, Mary. Her father liked John, but her mother disliked the unrefined son of a farmer. But eventually her mother relented, and they married in 1764. At this moment in time, she had just given birth to their first child, a daughter, nicknamed Nabby, where she, along with John, tried to come to terms with the beast, born in the disputes of the Seven Years' War that had awoken. They looked across the ocean and awaited Britain's response. In July 1765, word reached the Rockingham Ministry of the Virginia Resolves. Lieutenant Governor Fauquier mentioned that a hothead in the Burgesses had caused a commotion, but the matter was soon under control. The cabinet noted on August 30th. In October, darker stories began to emerge. Riots had broken out, officials' houses had been torn down, and they'd been forced to resign. You'll recall that the Rockingham Ministry was extremely inexperienced. Rockingham was only 35, the only senior figure with any experience of a crisis was Cumberland. Cumberland earned his wings fighting the Scots. He was very aggressive, and, as the Seven Years' War had shown, inept. Unsurprisingly, Cumberland argued for reprisal. He would not let American hooligans drive imperial policy. He chaired a meeting of cabinet on October 13th, and it was decided to take a hard line. Conway, the Secretary of State for the Southern Department, who was publicly pro-American, drafted a letter to the governors instructing them to use all necessary force to enforce the laws, with Major General Gage to support them as required. News kept arriving throughout the month of the chaos spreading out of New England and around the colonies. Cumberland decided that more force was needed, potentially troop deployments. He ordered a cabinet meeting on October 31st to decide on their plan of action. The American Revolution Doomsday Clock ticked closer and closer to midnight. The colonial elite were hoping that the British would not attempt to enforce the Stamp Act, as it would likely make the situation uncontrollable and their loyalties would be placed in an impossible position. But then, fate intervened. Shortly after dinner, on the 31st of October, 1765, the Duke of Cumberland suffered either a stroke or heart attack and died. This left the Rockingham Ministry with no direction, no authority figure, no experience, and no support from the King. The British government would need to be remade, a process that could take months. Exactly one day before the Stamp Act was due to be enforced on November the 1st. This is where we'll leave things for this week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time. After the Virginia Resolves were published in New England, with a few new clauses, a series of riots broke out.
Sorry, I can't search by topic.
No, by Siri, shut up. Shut up, Siri. Categories like thrill. Stop talking.